Okay, this is Karen Blomquist, and the fifth in the series, Work, Justice, and the Church, and this final session toward more just work. What I'd like to do is to just set some things forth in terms of some criteria, some ethical principles, some marks of what it might look like to have a society or a world of more just work, and after I lay these out, we can talk, do some grappling with those, and talking about some of how that happens, the prospects, the realities, and that sort of thing. Certainly, I think one of the basic kind of criteria is that work should involve material income sufficient to sustain life. And therefore, the kind of thing we were talking about 2-3 days ago with the diagram from Edwards' book, Contested Terrain, of how many people end up getting stuck in that secondary labor market where the income is, in a lot of cases, hardly sufficient to support oneself, much less one's family, is something that I think needs to really be called into question, the kind of inadequate, unjust, underpaid kind of work in our society. And of course there, in connection with this, there's that whole tension that then emerges between what people need and what people deserve, although I find it very difficult to think of certain corporation presidents deserving $1.5 million or whatever some of those, I forgot what the top kinds of incomes are these days. But I think indeed, we need to think as Christians about supporting policies that involve a lid on what we need, and how quickly, you know, needs become endless, or, you know, it's not just what we basically need, but it's what we ever, you know, the ever new desires, but also a need on what it is, or also putting a lid on what it is that we deserve. You know, who really deserves $500,000. Well, I don't know. I think, you know, we need to have a lot more public conversations about the kind of, you know, enormous variety of salaries, etc. So certainly that business, and especially some of the injustice involved in what women earn in many jobs in our society, the kind of conversation we had last night is a part of this first kind of point. But what I'm more interested in dealing with this morning is what it might mean to talk about a just structure of work. Not just the just pay for the work, but a just structure of work. And I'm going to be drawing somewhat heavily from this book that I mentioned, although I haven't dealt really that specifically with what they've said prior in our sessions, the book by John Raines and Donna Day Lauer, Modern Work and Human Meaning, a recent Westminster Press publication. And one of the points they make there, and I think it's something that as Christians we really need to hold up as a kind of basic principle, is that poverty is more than a lack of money, but poverty also involves being denied participation in society, being involved, being denied meaningful participation in society. And so in their treatment of the subject of just work, Raines and Delor try to chart out three dimensions or three aspects of what a just structure of work might involve. First of all, the work is work that is meaningful. It is work that supports meaningful community and that enhances human decency toward one another, rather than work that occurs amidst really squalid kinds of human conditions, the kind of, you know, sweatshop or some of the horrendous images of work in this country in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and, you know, conditions of work that are pretty deplorable in lots of parts of the world even today. Work is that is meaningful is work that is intelligible, that makes sense, And I think what's come up already in our conversations is how ridiculous some of the ways in which work gets ordered or some of the company policies or rules end up being, when anybody with some amount of sense can readily say, hey, you know, that just doesn't make sense to do it that way. Work is not only about how we make a living, but it is how we dwell together meaningfully and well. Work needs to be seen as a way of cooperating, of working together with one another. And I think that, set in juxtaposition with the usual connotations of work in our society, namely work as a way we compete with one another, and therefore that biblical kind of principle that we talked about the very first day is, you know, work is cooperative, it is expressive of who we are, namely as social beings, is something that really gets overshadowed by some of the usual connotations of work in our society. So I think that work is cooperating is certainly in juxtaposition to the individualism and the competitiveness that work so often spawns. Let me just share with you a paragraph from this book where they describe what it's like when work becomes unjust. When work becomes unjust, it is not poverty that is its central or necessary symptom, but the collapse of a sense of shared well-being. And isolation and individualism grow up. We do not expect much from others, and we refuse to have others expect much from us. We lose a sense of common good that encourages moral discipline and obligation. Rather than bind us together, work drives us apart. Work makes sense to us only as an instrument of individual advancement. We no longer learn from our work that we need and depend upon one another. Work therefore becomes unjust through such developments as rapid changes in society or in the world of work, becomes unjust at times through the very design of technology. And one of the things they cite is what happened in the case of Three Mile Island and the accident there, and how, you know, there's a whole technology of how that plant was to run and what was to happen at what point, that, and the technology really took over. So the human beings who, just because of their own common sense or their own skills and awareness of what was going on, who could have done something, didn't, because, you know, there was the whole technology set up as to, you know, what would take care of what. And therefore, technology at times like that ends up undermining confidence in human effectiveness and human skill and really cuts off human creativity, or, to speak biblically, cuts off that potential in us as, you know, created in God's image, created to be co-creators with God, and that potential gets undermined or cut off. So work is no longer seen as being under the control of our active understanding. And therefore, the many comments, some of them that have been uttered this week, well, you know, it's really stupid to do it that way, which to me is, you know, that comment itself is a comment of hope, because it's that awareness that, hey, you know, the way things are structured doesn't make much sense. And human beings make comments like that when we realize, that we still are smarter or better than the machines, even though so much of the way work is organized would make it seem as if the machines are the boss or the smart ones, and we're just the ones that are the objects of the machine. So I think that, you know, that standing up and that kind of protest of work conditions is something that we in the church need to be far more attuned to than we sometimes have, because I think that is not only the possibility of some real consciousness raising, but I think that's really the seed of moral insight, moral courage in people standing up and saying, hey, no more, we won't let things operate with that kind of assumption. So a just structure of work is a structure of work that is meaningful. Secondly, it involves participation. It is participatory. And here's where I think there's a lot of good stuff in the American Catholic Bishop's pastoral on the economy. A lot of important things there about work. How justice demands the establishment of minimal levels of participation by all persons in the life of the human community. In fact, that's really what they end up defining as a moral community, a community in which human beings are participants in that rather than simply passive objects of, quote, the way things are. So underlying this whole notion of participation as a criteria of just work is that very basic notion that we are fundamentally created as social beings, not as isolated individuals. When I was trying to deal with this in some of my dissertation work, Rosemary doesn't know this, but I contrasted the way in which Niebuhr deals with individuals and the way in which Rosemary has in some of her work and as interpreted by Judith Vaughn and some other people. But that whole notion that we express our socialness, our sociality through our work. You know, it is not that we are first isolated individuals, but if we read those Genesis accounts again, you know, we are created in community. You know, the first earth creature is created, and then the second earth creature is created primarily for the purpose of companionship, for community, for that sense of socialness that is basic to who we are as human beings. So through participation in work, we build moral meaning and direction into our lives. And we realize that the future depends in part on what we do. Now you'll note there's a resemblance there with some of the all that good life cycle we were talking about earlier in the week. But the problem is that's the notion of, you know, the future depends on what we do, taken to a very individualistic kind of extreme. And so indeed I think that sense of being active agents in the world that we're creating is a very basic part of biblical mandate. But seeing that as something that happens in participation and cooperation with others rather than in the very individualistic ways that it has often been interpreted in our society. Being denied work or working under demeaning conditions therefore injures or inhibits our moral growth. We become demoralized. That very word, demoralized, we don't often think of it in the way that it's taking away that which we need to be moral agents in society. Active participation is our way of being and becoming human. And again, I'm thinking now of work in that total sense, not just that limited sense of what we do to earn money, but that total process of how we express ourselves and how we exercise what it means to be co-creators with God. And therefore, obviously, this perspective on what just work is all about points rather specifically at the human tragedy of this ever-increasing pool of those who are permanently unemployed and cut off from that possibility. I think we need to, as church folk, we need to insist far more strongly than we have that the right to work is a fundamental human right. And yet that's not often one that is interpreted that way. Jobs must be generated by our public policy. You know, that such things as tax breaks, I think, need to be far more linked than they have with whether or not a company is generating more jobs. Purposely increasing unemployment in order to do such things as control inflation is a kind of thing that I think we need to raise some very deep ethical questions about whether that's an adequate kind of public policy. And certainly one of the trends that I think is extremely important in a society that talks a lot about political democracy are finding ways in which we could begin to move toward more of an economic democracy. You know, and I'm aware of all the flags that raises, all the red flags and all of the fears that business people have about that. But I think we need to, from a Christian perspective, think far more than we have about economic structures that engender an active participation of workers and of communities in those economic decisions that directly impinge upon them. And therefore, what happened, how does a community have any control over or any voice in what that major corporation that employs two-thirds of that community, what they do, and how quickly they're able to just say, well, we're going to leave this town and go to where things are a bit more profitable. I think we really fool ourselves when we think that those economic decisions are purely private kinds of matters, but they have enormous public ramifications, and therefore I think it's, there really needs to be some kind of public accountability built into that. It seems as though when persons and communities begin to participate in some ways in some of those decisions, then there begins to emerge a new awareness of and a new sense of responsibility. So it's a matter of saying that we all are, we all suffer, and we are all demeaned in terms of our own moral responsibility when we are cut off from participation in some of those very basic kinds of economic decisions that are made. And finally, a third dimension of what just work or what the structure of just work might look like that's pointed to in this book is the priority of shared skills, or as John Paul said in his encyclical on work, the priority of labor, and not simply the matter of the maximization of profit. Not that profit is unimportant, but that something else needs to be factored in there besides the sole criteria of the maximization of profit. Not seeing human beings primarily as instruments of production, or in other words, as objects, but seeing human beings as the subjects of work. Work is for human beings, not human beings for work. Realizing that all work is rooted within the historical continuity of the human community, and that it is rooted, therefore, also within the global community, and not just on a local basis, but on a national and in an international kind of context. What needs to be protected are the skills of workers and of their communities. And I think we need a lot more of thinking of what it means to take seriously the priority of shared skills on an international kind of level. Real economic development depends on the conscious cultivation of human skills and bonds of human community, not simply on the logic of highly mobile international capital that is not accountable to human persons and communities. And therefore, one of the things that Rains and De Lauer point to is the importance of, certainly of democratic developments, but also the importance of education and consciousness raising in the third world in order to be able, so that they can enter into the kind of international economic decisions and developments from a position of at least a bit greater strength of being able to say no to big companies and to say, hey, what does it mean in the midst of this huge global market for us to become active agents in that rather than just objects whose people are used because they're cheap labor and therefore serving the interests of those who are the huge economic powers in the world. So I think it's a combination of those factors, recognizing that you know, none of those are going to be easy public policy kinds of shifts to make, especially under some of the present assumptions and the present kind of momentum that we are so caught up in. But I think those are the kinds of priorities that Christians and others who try to operate with some ethical perspectives in the midst of all this need to bring to bear in terms of some of the public policy kinds of decisions that can make. So let me just stop and get some of your comments, examples, how this might begin to get fleshed out in terms of concrete examples, whatever you want to go with.
I wondered if you saw the film on the Pullman Company, you know, mm-hmm. about the sadness of that whole thing that someone was brought into, the company was sold and someone was brought in to control the company that made poor decisions, and the cars, the workers could see that the cars were not being well built. Mm-hmm. And they were very angry about it but could do nothing about it. And many of the workers, then the company was sold again and someone else purchased it who decided to turn it into another type of product. And these people had been making these cars for three generations, and they had hoped to get the New York subway contract, and it was given to a Canadian company instead. It was very, very sad. I felt really good feel for them. Because there was a case where people were really emotionally involved in the company, which is, you know, something very unusual, but they had been for three generations emotionally involved in it. Wasn't it Lincoln's son who started the Pullman car?
There's an actual communal neighborhood that was built mm-hmm. for the Pullman workers to live in by the company.
It's very much a company town.
Yeah, it's a company town, but it created a whole special sociology. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long it lasted, but I mean that still exists as a
It must
have been like three generations.
It may or may not have been good.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I think it nevertheless linked a group of people to that company.
Indeed.
In a different way.
Vested interest in the company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of paternalism mm-hmm. in the whole concept mm-hmm. of the town. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a lot of times when one tries to make a point like this, you know, hey, they were making these products and, you know, that community and all that sort of thing, that's often interpreted as being an anti-change kind of position, you know, somehow it all needs to stay the same. No, I don't think it needs to be interpreted that way, but it's a matter of saying, hey, what kinds of humanizing criteria need to be brought into that process of change, recognizing that, yeah, you know, we're not going to keep making the same old products and, communities will change, but can we avert the kind of human disasters?
Right. That and often to point out that they were doing making a poor quality thing, which the workers could see it was poor quality, and mm-hmm. they wanted to tell, but they were afraid to tell.
Well, part of the structure there is the lack of any structure that would allow worker participation.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. When a person feels they don't have any stake in the decision. Mm-hmm. It's a dehumanizing, and it's a sense of powerlessness, because mm-hmm. I'm the victim of.
Yeah. I remember being a part of this as an early teacher before I was married, and we came to a brand new school, and were allowed to plan our room. Specialized teachers were allowed to plan their rooms, and what a joy it was to work with the architect and let him know what the teacher needed, not just what the architect thought you needed. But it was a real joy. It really was. Mm-hmm. I'll never have that experience again, I don't suppose.
Did you then get to teach in that school too? Or?
Right. Yeah, it was just a real thrill.
Ken, I wasn't here for, I just came yesterday, mm-hmm. so I haven't had the benefit of a number of the earlier discussions. And so I hesitate a bit about raising questions, but as you went through your issues and your sort of overview of what might be an approach to a solution or an ethic, Christian ethic or generalized ethic, justice and work. I just came up with lots and lots of questions or potential conflicts. Mm-hmm. For example, if we're talking about work needs to be meaningful, but we're also talking about needing to create jobs and maintain jobs as a matter of public policy. At least in the past, that tends to have been contradictory. When you make work, the work tends not to be meaningful because it's being made, I mean, being...
It's kind of make work.
It is make work, yeah, literally. You see that in some of the new policies about if you're going to get welfare, you have to work, and then what sort of jobs do they come up with? Or when they were talking about alternate service as a substitute for the draft, the type of work that people were was being proposed would not be particularly meaningful. And the only reason it was going to be there was that because everyone was supposed to work if you didn't, if you weren't, you know, too few people. The Army only needed so many people. There was a much larger pool of 18-year-olds. And so we're going to have, and to be fair to everyone, everyone would have to spend 2 years of service, either in the Army or something else. And then when they try to create what that work would be, the question of its meaningfulness came up. Another one is, if we're talking about a whole community versus a local community, all the discussions about protectionism come in. If we allow the Pullman car company to make, and this is not a good example to make my point, but since you raised it, if they get the New York contract, and of course the Canadian company with its workers,
were in Vermont. Yeah, it's a Canadian company.
Yeah, doesn't. And that raises to me an even broader question, is that you seem to pose an alternative of individualism versus community, and yet our complex society, there's an intermediate position which seems to be correspond more to society as I understand it, which is a pluralistic one, where you have, you don't have a full community, mm-hmm. you don't have merely individuals, although there's certainly a tendency towards individualism. Instead, you have lots of different competing groups. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, what's good for the textile workers in our country and protecting their jobs may be devastating to the farmers who, you know, but the response of foreign competitors to protectionism in textiles to limit our export of agricultural products. And so what you have is you have competing interests. I'll stop with those two examples. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few points as you were bringing up where it seemed to me that the ideal, which I would subscribe to too, is incompatible with the complexity of the economy that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I think the three basic principles that they're setting forth here about the just structure of work, the idea is that somehow those need to be held in tension, and I think that's partly a recognition of the kind of thing you're pointing to. You know, if we just talk about meaningful work, well, yeah, then yeah, everybody having a job, yeah. Yeah, I think those are very real kinds of things. The difficulty is we often don't even get to the point of discussing those tensions that emerge when we do stand by some of these basic principles or criteria. So yeah, I agree that those are the, and that's why I said, you know, the reality of how one then works that out. Those are two good examples of that.
I think the question of creating work and then assuming that it will be make work really reflects the lack of creativity of the people who look at the situation. The inability to really see the whole dimensions of human need that are being neglected and the mm-hmm. possibilities. And I think an example of work project, New Deal kind of thing, where they decided to give work to all kinds of artists to do public sculpture and murals and post offices, and really put a whole generation of artists to work doing stuff that was obviously very meaningful.
And some of the public works that were done then are still around.
Yeah, I mean, many a post office still is really graced by the stuff that was created.
And yeah, the environment was enhanced too by some of the work that was done during the
waysides
and the national forests.
The trouble is that, I mean, the WPA was brought up as an example when they were talking about alternate service mm-hmm. and the draft. And the trouble is that the number of people you're talking about, it very quickly, before long you have paths everywhere and you have the post office and you still have a lot of people left over. And then you also run into the problem that this is a way of, ends up often being a way, in finding jobs, it's it leads to another problem, which is then the people who have the work are not paid very much. For example, one of the proposals was in California they'd be used for fighting fires, which were to protect private timber. And the way that normally is paid for is that they, is, you know, it's part of the cost of that timber land, and the owners of that timber have to pay a decent wage. If the bill had gone through, these people would have a tremendous windfall, and the people, the 18 and 19 year olds who are being paid, would not be paid a living wage for this work, which would benefit the private.
I mean, this clearly reflects who decides, you know, who's creating this work and for whose
purpose. And the ethical premises of that those who decide base their decisions on.
I think that's probably true to a degree, but I'm suggesting that beyond that, there may be a structural issue involved. That if we're talking about numbers that are sufficiently great, that it may not be a matter of just people of goodwill making the decisions.
I'm not talking about people of goodwill. I'm talking about the fact that there's an enormous amount of need that's not being served, and that the decision making doesn't really come from those sectors that want to take care of those human needs.
I mean, just basic things like child care workers, helping to clean up neighborhoods, etc. Things that are very much community serving. They are not just make work kinds
and
of things.
I think the whole question of what is meaningful or not, people can find very rote kind of work meaningful or unmeaningful depending on very much on the kind of sense of community that this goes on. People can do all kinds of road work and dish work and so on around here and finding meaningful because it's embedded in a certain kind of community. So I think there's some variables in terms of what people find meaningful, and I think it has a lot to do with the sense of not simply being alienated people who are bossed around, but rather a community of people who are making decisions
together.
It's not the basic character of the work, but it's the interdynamics connected.
The environment in which the work is carried out.
And the extent to which people feel like they're really just making some, being able to be treated as human beings, making some decisions about the work together.
It seems to me, though, in our society, we supposedly decide, we show we have a need for some service by the $1, one vote system. And if you want to have child care, you say, gee, I need a child care facility. And if somebody perceives that need in their community, they're going to start one up, and they will hire a workforce to staff it. And I guess I don't understand at all the concept of just per se creating jobs. It just isn't done. You have a demand for something that needs to be met, and then somebody responds to that demand. And to compensate the person for them responding to your need, you compensate for them. Maybe you trade them with a bushel of wheat, or maybe you give them $10 for that day when they took care of your child so you could go to work somewhere else and earn $30 or whatever. But the concept of just creating jobs seems totally alien to me.
Oh, well, I'm saying that indeed there are plenty of needs in society, you know, that need to be attended to that have not usually been the needs that we've chosen to address by jobs in this, you know, because those are usually not the big profit kind of, well, I mean, child care is a whole profit-making industry. I mean, it's becoming more and more of that, but I'm suggesting that, you know, the needs indeed are there. It's not just creating jobs for the sake of creating jobs, but there are some very real needs there. That's
what I thought. I was assuming we were talking in terms of the wrong people are making the decisions as to what what things need to be done. It seems what I'm saying is our society as a whole decides what jobs need to be done because we with the resources we gather through our efforts turn around and say, I would like to have these things done for me, and I'll take what I got for my effort and pay you so that you can do the kinds of things you're much better at doing than I am. Mm-hmm.
You're suggesting the market system works.
Yes, I am. Okay. I think it does, basically. And what I think we are we aren't overlooking it. This gentleman here, I think quite clearly stated it, is when we have work that we would like to keep for ourselves, but we've got to recognize that there are other people in the world, is the way I would look at it, that would also like to be able to do things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I hear, I get the feeling that we always say that everyone in the world is being used by the employers of the world, but I think there are people, say in Taiwan or Korea or some of these emerging, I can't speak to the third world because I don't know, I don't think the kinds of industry that America would have to export, if we thought that was a wise thing to do, could be picked up readily by people with that different a culture. But in places like Taiwan or Korea, I think people are tickled to death to get this exported work and up their income from $1,500 a year to $2,000 a year, and maybe that's part of the price that I've got to pay for world justice, is I've got to give up my $20,000 job and settle for $15,000 so that 10 other people in the world can earn an extra $500 a year. That's sort of my philosophy, that there's a certain amount of demand in the world and the world has a fixed amount of resource. And right now, it's terribly allocated. There's way too much in the United States. And what I try to temper my dissatisfaction in seeing how things seem to be going downhill in the American workplace, mm-hmm. is that things are getting much better elsewhere, where we've been just take from all these other countries, and now by exporting of industry and exporting some technology, some of those people are being able to afford more than just food on their table. They can now afford a new set of clothes every year and those sorts of things. So I try to, as I say, balance it. See, some of the hardship that we're going through is maybe going to end up being joy somewhere else.
The tragedy is that so often it's not permanent joy, like the factories are already moving out of Korea to cheaper labor markets, yes. Mm-hmm. So that the owners are finding their industries very transportable almost on the basis of where they find the cheapest mm-hmm. labor.
So I think that market model has basically been obsolete for about 200 years, and that fundamentally, if you look at the actual structures of big companies, there's a whole structure of governmental support that goes on. I mean, they're not running on any kind of pure market system. Needless to say, all kinds of public sectors of our society, you've got an enormous military system, which is certainly not a market economy. It's a state socialist economy.
I agree with that.
And it, you know, it would go out of business fast if it had to base itself on the market economy.
Yeah, the other thing I think it's also a mixed picture, you know, as to whether those third world workers really are thriving. You know, I think mm-hmm. sure in some cases that's the case.
Very,
but
very temporary.
In some cases what it's done is introduced even greater disparities between those who have and those who don't have in the society.
We came from Oregon a couple of years ago back to California, and in Oregon things were really getting very bad. The parks were not being kept up, and there wasn't enough money for that. There wasn't enough money to keep the libraries open, and just about 4 days a week, and not in the evenings and things like that. And that also is starting to happen in California, as the funds are being drained now down to the bottom, and everything they've relied upon after Proposition 13 is now gone. And mm-hmm. so we're having a hard time keeping our libraries open and charging for all the park use, which is hard on the poor people who can't afford to pay to go to those parks. But and in Washington, our son-in-law was a landscape architect for parks and playgrounds, and showed us recently in Olympia where they, the ones too that he had planted, just the bushes are almost covered with weeds. And that's really sad when you think of all the money and time and energy that was put into those, that now they're turning back into just weed beds. And there's something wrong. I mean, something needs to be done and taken care of. In Oregon, they have taken to importing people that are retired to come for the summer and live in a park for nothing, with their mobile or their tents or whatever, and at least keep the tables washed and the bathrooms filled, and that's, you know, as much as probably elderly people can be expected to do. But that was one way out, you know, trying to keep the park systems alive.
Certainly an example, that whole phenomenon that Bella and company talk about in Habits of the Heart, that whole loss of a sense of community, the common good.
And I think it's wrong. I don't know where it is, but it's very, very wrong. The whole, and you know, I don't think sometimes, it's coming to the rest of America too, but I think it hit us first out here.
I think the problem is us, not the system. The problem is we'd rather buy VCRs than pay taxes so that our government can afford to sustain those facilities.
Have you looked at the national budget recently?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that the reason is very clear. The whole public policy of the Reagan administration is taking from the infrastructure of public welfare that supports all of these kind of things to the military budget. And the drain is very clear when you look at what the priorities of the public budget.
And also the philosophy that we don't have responsibility in the private sector, that's up to business or voluntary organizations. And, so the tax dollar that we share has no commitment to the human side of life that we're talking about here. And that's another tragedy, I think.
And part of the, you know, the decisions to buy VCRs rather than money that can serve the common good, you know, that itself is a structurally caused kind of factor. I mean, that's why we did the whole thing on the American dream and that good life kind of
making
cycle.
Making it consumption. There's,
yeah, I mean, it's part of the ideology, that ideology and the consumerism and all the other stuff connected with that are part, is a part of the structural reality within which we make those seemingly very personal decisions as to how we're going to spend our money or what we're going to do or how we're going to, where our lives are going to go.
I sometimes get the feeling in listening to these conversations that we are trying somehow to find someone, some group, or some organization to rest the blame for all of these structural kinds of things you're talking about, or these injustices. And I guess that's where I would agree with Dennis, is that where we need, talking about this is a healthy thing, but we need individually to face up to these kinds of things. And it's very easy to pass off on big business or government or whomever, whatever organization or group that we happen to take offense with. But we individually have to face up to that and try to do something about that. And I guess I'd really like to hear some input as to where some of those places are, that how we can do that. I personally have been in a situation where I guess I have worked in what is called big business and have had not a lot of people, but up to 70 or 80 people who have been my responsibility, so to speak. And I have tried to practice some of the things you've been saying, that in terms of justice, to me I call those good management techniques. Those are things that need to be done to form the community, to form people so they're involved. And those are ways in which more better things happen for everybody. Better things happen for the workers, better, and profits are a result of that. Profits increase. Those are management techniques. But it's also frustrating from that side that it's not as easy to do, because those, quote, workers at whatever level they are don't always respond to those kinds of things, and don't, they choose not to be part of that. And that maybe could be debated as to whether or not that was good or bad motivation, but they choose not to be part of that. An example is when you have a situation where there is not enough work, and I refer in this case to a situation which was a union, a situation where we gave the choice to a group of people of saying we could lay off one person or everybody can reduce their hours to share in that. And that's putting it on the people involved. And sometimes the answer was yes, we'll share it, sometimes it wasn't. So it's not always an easy choice, and I guess I just feel sometimes it's just so easy just to put the blame on that group on it, because somehow that group seems not part of us. But I submit that every one of us are really part of that group, whether it be big business or big government or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to respond to that. And sometimes I think the conversation sometimes gets a little negative, it kind of pushes the blame
out
from us. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the ways that, you know, theologically I am continually trying to set that forth is that within the Christian tradition there's a twofold understanding of sin. Sin as a power of domination, you know, as that which we don't quite know how to deal with. You know, that which we don't do, but it's somewhat akin to some of our notions of what original sin is in our tradition. But then there's the other pole or the other aspect of sin is personal responsibility. And I think the difficulty is we go with one or the other without seeing the necessary tension in between. So that yeah, I would say yeah, we need to talk about our implication in that. It's not just that we can wipe our hands clean and say, oh, those bad companies or that bad government or whatever. I think we do need to name that at times, but not in a way that says, you know, somehow we're totally,
totally
come off
clean
and we just take pot shots.
I really think one area we're all going to have to move into much more than fits our individualism is community organization or citizen organization, where we gather around self-interest, to be very frank about it. And I think when we do that, we find it brings an interesting assortment of people together who find that they have the same self-interest, and by moving together, things can change.
Even though their politics might be quite different.
That politics might be very different, yes. Whether it's over a community issue or a job issue or a political issue, I think that's the only way to bring about social change. People get very frustrated individually trying to create a new social environment because it seems so hopeless. But working together, there are victory successes, I think. And we talked a little bit about that. You mentioned that one situation, was it Indiana or Illinois? This young woman who's in the Roman Catholic Church. It's been a part of the
Calumet City area.
Mm-hmm. That's one good example of that.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about some more of those kinds of things next week. Yeah, I think that's why what's crucial are having some overarching principles, some ethical principles that we bring to bear in these discussions. Not assuming that that's going to be constructed in an easy, clear-cut kind of way, but having that, you know, having a place to stand, i.e., the community of faith and the perspectives that come from out of that. In the midst of all of those business decisions and the rest that need to be made, to me becomes part of what's key to that.
Point of information, did you earlier in the week, with your discussion of sin and two aspects of sin, is the very first time I've heard any traditional language.
You did that.
Yeah, it seems to me that a lot of the way of thinking tends to create a kind of dualism between the isolated individual and how this isolated individual will somehow take responsibility, and the great global systems, which are, you know, so far out of the reach of any influence of individuals. I mean, I could say that everybody who voted for Ronald Reagan is partly responsible for the present military budget, but I mean, there's all kinds of intermediary systems.
Mm-hmm.
And how you start working at the level of some intermediary system that might have an impact on this issue in this context. I mean,
that's where
a neighborhood organization is the level of organization perhaps to address, you know, safety in that particular neighborhood and so on. And so how you start figuring out having some impact on appropriate levels of organization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, the isolated individual is not
feels
impacted
helpless.
At all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
started thinking about my college son just started working for Best Buy Company in Minneapolis, and it's a progressive. They're opening 100 new stores. But their theory is don't complain unless you can change something about us. Okay, does that shut him up so he can't, I mean, does that make a more of a person who just works like a robot without any free complaint? Of course he can't change anything, he's too young. But is that good? I don't know, I've been thinking about that both ways.
Two-edged
sword, isn't it?
They say don't complain unless you can change.
Unless you have the answer. Unless you can suggest something else. Yeah,
something better.
But so, of course he can. He's too young into the business. So that's going to make him not say anything, you know, and yet it'll make him more tolerant of everything they say.
Again, it seems to me to kind of isolate the individual and the system and not think that maybe...
At first, I thought that's nice. Everybody think about it.
And yet, sometimes somebody coming into an organization with a fresh look can see things and indeed solutions or possible solutions that someone who's been a part of the problem.
Right. So it is. It can go with both ways.
What I'm saying is, I think he has a chance.
This also relates back to that whole theological circle that I was sharing on Thursday, I think it was. I was dragging the days up here. Where I think most of the time what happens in terms of the church's response to that kind of situation is we get stuck on the first step, the, you know, what's going on with both seeing, hearing, and feeling. Mm-hmm. And therefore, well, you know, yeah, you've got a complaint and you're feeling frustrated with this and that, and it's like, you know, we just kind of leave it there, rather than moving on to what I described as the second step of really grappling with why it is that way. And again, here doing a kind of analysis that avoids too simplistic a solution to that, but, you know, trying in conversation with one another to point to some factors that could be changed. But most of the time, those complaints remain very individualized, and therefore the possibility of change, not in maybe big, highfalutin kinds of ways, but in terms of some concrete changes that can be made, that possibility is cut off, and what ends up happening is our sense of surplus powerlessness gets fed.
Whereas if there's just one small change to begin with, it gives people courage to try again to move forward together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that in and of itself becomes empowering.
Yes, it does.
The next step.
I was going to say one other thing that I noticed living in an area where crafts and artwork and that type of thing is very important. Oregon is known for all of its crafts. It's kind of like the Appalachian area, I guess. But many of the artists were leaving the area because no longer did the people have the money to buy their ware, as small as it was. They didn't have the money to buy it. And I don't know what that says. They've gone to better lands where they're selling more, I guess, and or gone into industry, one or the other, and left the crafts. And but I do think that maybe the churches have a responsibility. Art and music were promoted by the early churches, the early Catholic churches all the way through the centuries. And maybe we need to help those people along. We have tried to have art shows in all of our churches and try to, maybe within the community, support each other a little better, things like that, or try to work within our own community and music things too. Mm-hmm. But it's,
well, one of the reasons art and culture, art too, has had a hard time is that there's been less of the federal dollar. That money has been shifted over to other categories. And so there isn't the governmental support which is necessary to promote good art, music.
Yeah, I think it worries me, it concerns me that we're losing something.
Yeah, I agree. I think the church has the church has the power. Why don't we use it? We have yesterday there was a comment about that companies ought to provide child care facilities for their laborers to make things easier. I think the last thing I want industry to be doing is taking care of my child. Why don't we get involved in that? Why don't we provide that service to our community? Who could better nurture the children of our community than the church? Mm-hmm. Why don't we do that?
Right. It is happening in a lot of
I guess people are worn out now. If you ask them to volunteer anymore, they're just going
to
be...
Yeah. Worn out, how can you expect industry that has no particular interest in that area to do it?
They have the money. And they also, in Palo Alto, you know, we lived there for quite a few years. In Palo Alto, we did see people like Syntax and some of the big companies that promoted art shows. They gave over their facilities to Stanford. They have a big kind of a day here, and they allowed people to come in and do internships, and they were humanizing in a lot of ways because they were pushed to do so, and then they found they liked it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, daycare has become an area for industry.
It sure has, very creatively.
I mean, every company offering for their
Hewitt
workers.
Hewitt Packard was giving lands for vegetable gardens, and so I think to humanize industry a little bit is maybe a job of the churches too.
Right. I want to put a cautionary note, because I think there is a kind of prevailing sentiment today that the church will pick up the slack in the face of all these government cutbacks. And that's the kind of thing, I guess, that the church, from my perspective, needs to much more be working toward certain public policy kind of changes, and not simply putting on the band-aids or picking up the slack when public institutions pull back and don't provide the parks or the funds for art or whatever.
Otherwise, we never get at the systemic.
You know, we end up doing the little bit here and the little bit there, rather than looking at the overall scene and, you know, what government priorities need to be challenged at those points.